gonna risk that cry for help. Cause you need to show him that you love him more than you ever loved anyone else. You're never gonna be let out, you're never gonna leave this house. But together we can set you free, I can get you everything you'll ever need. Hopeful song, what a beautiful melody. And it goes la da di da di da, la di da da da. Singing through the pain, la la di da da, la di da di da da da.
Hello, my name is Amai Campbell, and I am happy to welcome you to this year's Native Youth Program. My team and I present you to our audio documentary called Where We Began, a collection of origin stories on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting from UBC Vancouver campus, located on the unceded and unsurrendered lands of the Musqueam people. The NYP is a work-learn program that is held at the Museum of Anthropology here on the UBC campus every summer. This year is the program's 42nd year, making it at MOA's longest-running public program. Throughout the summer, the six of us wrote, recorded, and edited these stories that you are about to hear. Some of them are stories from our nation, and some are personal stories. All of these stories hold a personal significance to us, and we are excited to share them with you today. The name Musqueam relates back to the flowering plant Muthgwe, which grows in the Fraser River estuary. There is a story that has been passed on from generation to generation that explains how we became known as the Musqueam people of the Muthgwe plant. Elders spoke of a lake, Mumqueam, known today as Camosun Bog. Before colonization, it was a wellspring of food, medicines, and natural materials that the Musqueam people relied on for everyday life and trading. This is where the Si'ilki, the double-headed serpent, lived. They were warned as youth to be cautious and not go near the bog, or they would die or be taken by this entity. This serpent was so massive, its winding path from the lake to the river became the creek flowing through Musqueam to this day. As the serpent moved, everything the serpent passed over died, and from its droppings bloomed a new plant, the Muthgwe. Because of this, the people of long ago named that place Musqueam, Musqueam, the place of Muthgwe. I chose to do this story because I thought I could make a few connections with it, and I wanted to do an origin story for Musqueam, which is where I'm from. When I was younger, I remember my grandpa, who I call my papa, telling me the story of the double-headed serpent while I was watching him carve a talking stick inspired by the serpent. I've known about this story for quite a few years. The last time I remember hearing the story was when I was in the fifth grade. My teacher arranged a field trip to go to this Camosun Bog to learn about the Muthgwe plant, medicines, and to hear the story from a Musqueam elder. After this trip, I was able to have a much better understanding of the story, and ever since, I have always kept this story in my mind and close to my heart because of the importance it has to my people, and this is why you are hearing this story today. Hi, my name is Amai Campbell, and I am the person who just finished telling my story. My pronouns are she, her. I'm 14 years old, and I am Coast Salish from Musqueam and Zimbabwean African, and I am part of the Native Youth Program at MOA. I am currently attending school at Little Flower Academy and enjoy playing sports, more specifically basketball and volleyball, and I really enjoyed telling my story today. Thank you so much for listening.
Ever since I was little, my mom and I would visit Six Nations almost every summer where some of my family lives. It's the most peaceful place ever. It's quiet, and you can hear everything from the birds to the grass and gravel. It's located just outside of Toronto, Ontario. I think I was about 9 years old when I heard the creation story for the first time. One day, me and my cousins were playing outside when my uncle called us in. He was sitting in the living room on the couch. As we started to all join him, he started telling us the Haudenosaunee story of the Sky Woman. I can't tell the story as good as him, but I can at least try. Long, long ago, when the earth was just water, up in the sky was a world where Sky Woman lived. One day, the woman wanted some medicine from the Tree of Life. She made her way to this huge tree and started to look for these medicines. As she started to harvest, she fell through this hole that was near the bottom of the tree. She started falling into pitch dark unknown, but she managed to grab some strawberries and tobacco as she fell. A group of swans caught Sky Woman in the air and carried her safely onto the turtle's back in the water below. All the sea animals gathered around this strange being that fell from the sky. The Sky Woman then politely asked if any of the animals could grab her some dirt from the bottom of the ocean. The beaver tried first as he dove into the water, and he could only make it halfway down. Next, the otter tried. He made it further down to the bottom, but still couldn't reach the dirt. Lastly, the muskrat wanted to try. All the other animals laughed and made fun of him because they didn't believe he could because he was so small. They waited and waited for the muskrat to come back to the surface. Muskrat drowned, but his body finally floated to the top of the water. And in his paw was a handful of dirt. The Sky Woman took the dirt from the muskrat and started to slowly dance around the turtle's back. The more she danced, the more the turtle's back grew. We now call the turtle's back North America. This is how the Turtle Island got its name. Hi, my name is Tamara Hall. I am part of the Native Youth Program. On my father's side, I am Coast Salish from Musqueam, and on my mother's side, I am Mohawk, Ojibwe, and Cayuga. A few summers back, me and my mom went to Six Nations, and she wanted me to get a traditional name, so she asked my uncle. Our entire stay there, my uncle observed me and watched me until my name came to him. My name is Yingarla Yindirti, and it means she knows the stories. I chose to tell the story because it was very meaningful to me, because it always reminds me of when I was a kid and I got to travel back to Six Nations. And that's where I heard my nation's creation story for the first time.
Hi, my name is Gabe.
And my name is Tamara.
You're listening to Where We Begin, a collection of origin stories
by this year's Native Youth Program, working at the Museum of Anthropology.
Broadcasting on CITR 101.9 FM from UBC Vancouver campus.
Located on the unceded and unsurrendered lands of the Musqueam peoples.
A long time ago, in a time before time, back when the world was only water. There wasn't yet land, only an infinite expanse of sea and sky. Somewhere, swimming in that expanse, was Loon. On this day, Loon looked up at the sky, wonder in his eyes at the giant puffy clouds floating up there. He sighed with wonderment, and as he did, an idea popped into Loon's little head. With but a spark of hesitation, Loon lifted his wings above his head and sent himself flying upwards, soaring toward the clouds. After a while of flying, Loon finally flew high enough and glided down to a soft landing, setting his webbed feet gently on the fluffy cloud. As he looked around the cloud, a shape caught his eye. Walking toward it a moment, the loon recognized the strange silhouette, unmistakably, as a Haida house. Approaching it, he sat outside the house on the step, and for a while he waited, but the loon was not of the most patient sorts, so, after a time, he waved his wing and magically transformed himself into a human, and pushed open the door, entering the house. As he entered, he was met by the roar of a fire, blended with the low rumble of snoring. In the center of the room stood a towering bonfire. In the middle of the hearth sat two large stones, one slightly larger than the other, crackling in the ashes. Loon's eyes shifted to the snoring figure of an old man sleeping on the dirt behind the fire pit. Quickly, Loon, still in human form, shuffled over to the old man and began to try and shake him awake, to no avail. He tried yelling to wake him. No luck. For hours, he tried to wake the man to no effect. Eventually, Loon gave up, resigning himself to the porch at the house once more. And as he sat staring out over the clouds, his throat hitched, and he began to cry. After a moment, he steeled himself, deciding he would try again tomorrow, and deciding that the man would be sure to wake up in the morning. So, at dawn, once more did Loon enter the Haida house. Once more did he try and wake the old man, and once more all of his attempts were in vain, as the man continued to sleep. Soon, it became too much for Loon, as despair washed over him, and he rushed back out to the front step, sobs erupting from him, tears pouring down his face. Loon cried. And he cried. And he cried. For 3 days, Loon cried on the steps of that Haida house. On the dawn of the third day, however, something unexpected happened. A creak sounded from behind the loon, and turning back, peering through the tears, he saw the old Haida man, standing in the doorway, a grumpy expression on his face. He glowered at Loon.
Do you ever stop crying?
At Loon's confused and distraught expression, the old man rolled his eyes.
I can't sleep with all the damn noise you're making. What are you crying for, anyways?
Loon sniffled.
I came from down there. Down there. There's only ocean. We haven't any land. Only sea.
He did his best to gesture to the world beneath the clouds. The old man stared at the loon, motionless for a heartbeat, as if trying to read him. Another heartbeat passed. Then a third. Before the old man finally stepped inside, leaving just enough space for Loon to follow. As they step inside, the old man guides Loon to the place where he once slept. There they sat, and as they sat, they talked. As they talked, Loon explained to him about the world below. And all the while, the old man began to rub his tummy. Eventually, the old man reached inside of himself and pulled out from his belly a child, setting him on the ground. The old man stood, stepping on the child's feet, grabbing hold of his hands and pulling his arms upwards. And as he pulled, the child began to stretch, growing taller and taller. Taller than any human has ever been.
I'm going to make you taller than the Haidas. Taller than the people, chief.
After a moment he stopped, smiling proudly at his creation before turning him around.
Behind me, there is a box, he told him. Could you please go get it for me?
And just like that, the young man he had just created slept behind him into the shadows of the house, and returned a moment later with a beautifully painted box, just as instructed, setting it down in front of the old man, who thanked him before turning to the box. Gingerly, he opened the lid, revealing a second box inside, and inside that was another box, and another after that, until there were a total of 5 boxes strewn all around him. Inside the smallest box, however, there were 2 familiar stones, one slightly larger than the other. Gently, he reached in and lifted them out, giving them to the young man before turning back to Loon. He looked Loon in his eyes.
My friend,
he began, as he began to give him instructions. That night, Loon made his way down to the edge of the cloud, stones in tow, before taking one last long look at the Haida house, the old man, and his son. The old man smiled at him one last time, before Loon flew down toward the world below. When he finally reached it, he did as the old man told him, blowing quickly on the small rock before gently setting it down on the waves. And as he did, it began to float. He stared at where the rock floated for a moment, at the ripples it made in the water, before once more flapping his wings and soaring again into the sky. He flew until morning. He flew as long as he could. He flew until night fell once again, just as the old man told him to do. As he finally landed in the water, he took the larger rock and began to blow. For a while he sat there, blowing on the rock, before giving it one last look and tossing it into the sea. These rocks, dear listener, they grew. The smaller grew and became what we call the Haida Gwaii, the island my people come from. The larger rock grew much bigger than the smaller, becoming what we call the Big Island out there, or, the name you're more likely familiar with, the continent of North America. Our story does not end there, however. The child that the old man pulled out of his tummy, now an adult, I suppose, stood at the edge of the cloud, getting ready to make his own journey to the world below. Using his magic, he shifted, transforming it into a large black bird. As he spread his wings, the old man's voice called out from behind him.
"Not like that, y'all,"
he instructed, calling him by name.
"Tuck your wings to your side, and throw yourself off, and spiral down. Only then will you reach Haida Gwaii."
Y'all nodded before pitching himself off the edge, spiraling like a football toward the land below. As y'all reached the Haida Gwaii, he spread his wings, letting the air catch him before transforming back into his human-like form. Kneeling on the dirt, he began to run his fingers through the grass, savoring every moment of it. There he stayed for a while. Minutes, hours, days, weeks, he wasn't sure. Frankly, he didn't much care, for he was happy just enjoying the feeling of the land. But eventually he stood, before walking towards the beautiful forest just off in the distance. And as he walked, that's when he decided, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that this place was home. The end. Ha'a. Thank you. My name is Mackenzie Fong. I'm a Haida student worker at the Museum of Anthropology's Native Youth Program. That story you just heard was the creation of the Haida Gwaii and the birth of the raven from the southern Haidas in Skidigit on the Haida Gwaii, just off the coast of Prince Rupert. You also just heard my new song, Jailbird, throughout the episode.
I can get you everything you'll ever. You're a little jailbird, you're my little jailbird. Wings clipped, you can fly free.
My artist name is Epiphanie, spelled E-P-I-P-H-O-N-I-E. And yeah, if you liked it, feel free to go stream it. Thank you all for listening.
In the Inkla Kepma nations, creation stories are often told surrounding animals in vaguely human forms. Today, our story begins with two brothers, Coyote and Wolf, who had hatched a plan to steal a special ball the people of Lydon always played with. Before we get into our story, I would like to give a little insight on Coyote's background. During the big flood, he miraculously had a boat, finding himself to be the only person around, in which it became apparent that some mystical force had gifted Coyote with a bounty of power, seemingly to straighten up the world, for there was and were to be bad things coming. Now, though Coyote had the power to do good for the world, he's far too mischievous, constantly stirring up trouble. When Coyote was given his power, he was also given another brother, the fox. The fox had the ability to bring Coyote back to life in the form of whatever killed him, just by stepping over a piece of his hair. Coyote used Fox's gift to his advantage, letting his ego inflate, acting invincible to the point that he had no sense of self-preservation, and became far too reckless. Now, back to our story. When Coyote set his mind on something, there was no stopping him. The story is no different. Coyote wanted the Lydon ball, and he wanted it badly. I honestly couldn't tell you why. Here Coyote is with all this power to protect these people, and he goes and tries to stir up trouble. Wolf, Coyote's brother, warned him. No, those people are quite strong. You can't just go down there with those four skinny guys. In their human forms, Coyote and his sons were all skinny, gangly, and weak. Wolf and his sons were a bit stronger, so they decided to join the heist,
training on the rocky terrain by what's now known as Douglas Lake, because they knew it had a similar landscape to Lydon, and going on special diets to bulk up. Now, while the wolves were doing all this work, Coyote and his sons chose the flattest and easiest terrain to train on, constantly getting off task, cheating, and being lazy, and this went on for a full year, through summer and winter months, and then they were ready, or so they thought. Even though Coyote and his sons lacked the strength or discipline that Wolf's sons had, he was deluded enough to believe that they were the strongest and fastest. In his mind, his youngest would run down the river, snatch up the ball, and throw it across to the other who would be waiting, like a track star of sorts. Soon enough, the day of the heist came. Coyote used his powers to shapeshift the relayers into rock so it would remain inconspicuous to any onlookers. Wolf continued to try and persuade Coyote to let his sons take the runner positions, as they were stronger and least likely to be caught. Coyote wouldn't hear any of it, though, signaling for the heist to begin. As Coyote stayed atop the hill, he watched his boys run down to the two teams of people who were engaged in the tournament. Coyote's son grabbed the ball, and just as he threw it to his brother, he was also slain by the people of Lytton. When his brother caught the ball and threw it across, he was also slain. And this continued until all of Coyote's sons were dead. The last son was killed just as he threw the ball to Wolf's son. They had the ball now, but Coyote had no living sons. His selfish heart was breaking from the loss. But he was also arrogant that they had got the ball, and had a new goal in sight. He wanted to avenge his son's deaths. For 3 days, the surviving group kicked and played with the ball. It was a huge ball, bright and shiny. On the fourth day, Coyote pleaded with Wolf, got his brother's sympathy while secretly trying to undermine and manipulate him. "I am in deep sorrow. My children were slain on the journey we took to get that ball. They lost their lives for that ball. I made a mistake. Your children may have been a little wiser, but I put mine in front. That's how much love I have for your boys. Your boys are still alive. I weakened their first line before they reach you. I'd like to take the ball for the night, lie my head on it for the night, and weep for my sons." Once Coyote got the ball, he blew a concoction over his brother and his brother's sons that put them into a deep unconsciousness. Suiting up for battle, Coyote changed himself into an elk, put on the strongest armor, and broke the ball into two, using his magic to make it into an impenetrable shield. Now you see, whenever Coyote transformed into another being, nature demanded some balance in the form of a weakness. In his elk form, Coyote had a white spot under his throat that was the most vulnerable part of him. He was going to wipe the Lytton village out and kill all the Inklapatma people. As Coyote marched into the village, the Inklapatma people came out of their homes with weapons drawn. Coyote ended up killing far too many of their people, unyielding as they came on him with their bodies and weapons. Not a moment too soon, an elder appeared, figuring out that Coyote's weak spot was right under his throat. "I got it, right there, under his Adam's apple. There's an opening. Shoot your arrows there." They did, and the old coyote finally fell to the ground, the ball disappearing as he lay there dying. The ball he'd almost wiped out the entire Inklapatma nation for, lost his sons for, and betrayed his brother for, because he let his pride and ego get the better of him. When all the townsfolk finally cleared away, Fox came to bring Coyote back to life. And that's where our story ends, and a new one begins. Hi guys, so you just listened to the origin story of Coyote and Wolf from the Inklapatma Nation. My name is Mackenzie, or Kenzie for short, Q, and I'm Interior Salish from the Inklapatma Nation and white on my mom's side. I'm currently going to my senior year here in Vancouver. The book I got the story I just told you guys is called Our Tellings, Interior Salish Stories from the Inklapatma Nation. I also tried to interpret the text and tell the story as accurately as possible and to the best of my knowledge, as well as the pronunciations. Big thanks to the MYP manager Sephora, who showed me a book with not just one story from the Inklapatma Nation, but cover to cover filled with stories and information. So, why did I choose this story? Even though I am Indigenous, I grew up in a white household without any access to my native culture. Long story short, I'm not in contact with the native side of my family, those who are still alive, and my heritage is something I struggled with for a really long time. My knowledge of that side of my family is practically non-existent. I know my native family came from the Litton Band, but that's about the extent of my knowledge. So when we started researching origin stories a few weeks back, I was really set on choosing one for my own nation. For me, this project is more than just the story itself, it's where the story came from. Connecting me to my native ancestry through knowledge and learning. Hi, my name is Kenzie.
And my name is Kiara.
You are listening to Where We Began, a collection of origin stories
by this year's Native Youth Program working at the Museum of Anthropology.
Broadcasting on CITR 101.9 FM from UBC Vancouver campus.
Located on the unceded and unsurrendered lands of the Musqueam peoples. On January 16th, 2004, another life was brought into this horrid world in Prince Rupert, BC, and her name is Kiara Yeomans. She then lived with her mom and her older brother, who is 7 years older. Well, actually, she lived with her grandma more than her mom. During elementary school, Kiara went to the Museum of Northern British Columbia, where her mother worked as a school program director, a public program director, a bookkeeper, and a tour guide, as well as many more things. The list goes on and on. There, Kiara fell in love with everything, and also got a summer job where she danced and sang. At the age of 6, she was a working woman. Cruise ships with tourists would come into the museum, and that's where her job came in. She would dance and sing and tell stories at the longhouse to all of the visitors. She worked every weekend, as that is the time the cruise ships came in the most. She ended up getting $100 bills every other week, probably from her mom's check, but the little 6-year-old thought she got it all on her own. Later, Kiara was diagnosed with a bladder infection, but since she was so young, just 6 years old, it did not bother her very much. I mean, she couldn't grasp the big medical terms to begin with. But her whole life changed when she found out it wasn't just a bladder infection, but was also tethered cord syndrome, a neurological disorder caused by tissue attachments that limit the movement of the spinal cord within the spinal column. To put it simply, a tissue in the spine that is being stubborn and preventing certain movements for Kiara. The doctor said that it wasn't treatable in Prince Rupert, so she had to go to Vancouver. From living the life she knew as a small city girl, she traveled 749 kilometers to Vancouver, the big city, every couple of weeks. At that point, she had already been on more flights than most people take in a lifetime. All of the nurses knew and loved her. She was there so much, they just adored her. Then, the day came. In December 2011, she was brought in for spinal cord surgery to cut the tethered part of the cord. She had to train her brain to walk again. As soon as Kiara was told sports were an option now, she never stopped running. She then played every sport available to her now that she lived in Vancouver. She moved here shortly after the surgery because it was too much to travel back and forth. In her cross-country meets, the second place ribbon was always hers. Track and field, long distance, was her strong suit. In soccer, she was a wall, and no one could pass her on defense. Grade 3, for her, had only a couple of trips to the hospital. Then in grade 4, she joined hockey, and finally learned how to skate. Then in grade 6, basketball finally came into play, and she instantly fell in love with every single part of it. After a while, she missed home, where she had danced and sang. She then tried to reconnect in several ways. She weaved a cedar hat and listened to her mom tell stories from the Tsimshian Nation. But the person who changed her life the most since she moved to Vancouver was Katira. Katira and Kira became inseparable. They were each other's better halves. It was her and Katira against the world. High school world. From volunteering in so many things together to even moving into the same building. Something else changed. Her name. It is now Kira Yeomans-Stevens. She had finally taken her dad's last name, Stevens, and hyphenated her last name after him being in her life for so many years. She then wanted to be better than her brother, because she was always in his shadow as she went to the school he graduated out of, and they also shared the last name Yeomans. So, she joined student council in grade 9 as junior indigenous, then again in grade 10 as sports, and in grade 11 as co-indigenous, and finally in for her grade 12 year, she is one of two co-indigenous representatives. In grade 8, she was too scared to join student council after seeing all of the other kids running. Despite being scared, she always found a way to have her voice heard. She is also a part of a program called Girls Who Leap, who helped her come out of her shell more and be more herself. Then, COVID came in March 2020 and completely made the world freak out.
On this Saturday night, the number of COVID-19 cases climb across our country.
But she still continued to train for basketball at the end of the first lockdown. And she also ran a 17-kilometer run with her cross-country team, with little shorter meets every now and then. Sports was always her way of taking a break from reality and being herself. Hi, my name is Kira Yeomans-Stevens, and this is my story and how I used sports to help me find myself. I'm 17 years old and I am going into grade 12 in the 2021-2022 school year at Britannia Secondary. I am a part of the Native Youth Program at MOA. I am Tsimshian on my mom's side, and Niska on my dad's side. After spending so much time in the hospital, I want to become a pediatric nurse in the near future, so I can help all the little kids who are just like me. And as you can tell, my life is, and probably always will be, kind of crazy.
Avoidable questions. They always keep coming. Even though I answer, they grow back like pesky weeds. Ever since I was little, I was asked many things about myself and my culture. Plenty of times about my ethnicity. I remember some mixed reactions when I would tell people I'm Indigenous. This one particular memory stuck with me. When I told them I was Indigenous, someone gave me a judgmental look. I felt very confused and self-conscious. I went back and asked my dad, who told me I'd face a lot of racism as I grew older. I would be asked questions on many sensitive subjects, for instance, residential schools. I would avoid a lot of those questions, saying I didn't have an answer. But the older I got, the more I realized how inappropriate those questions were. Sometimes I just want to bop them in the nose and tell them to shut up. I was always proud to say I'm Indigenous, but I didn't know what that truly meant. I remember having many questions when I wondered about my culture. When my friends talked about theirs, I became more curious about mine. I did not grow up surrounded by my traditions, and it was hard to learn more about them when my connections were difficult to learn from. My birth mother took her knowledge with her when our paths separated.
I was very young when it happened, so I didn't have a chance to remember anything from her unlike my older siblings. I was practically a baby, and they were older, so they remember more of her. I'm Métis, Cree, and Soto. Back when I would ask my siblings, I would forget when someone asked which nation I'm from. I didn't have my siblings there to correct me if I got it wrong. When we had Indigenous trips at school, or if my family went to Indigenous food gathering, I would feel like I didn't fit in. I felt like I needed to be more knowledgeable in order to be Indigenous. I didn't know anything about my culture, and I admit it, it bothered me. When I think about why it bothered me, I think about one word, wish. The reason why I think of the word wish is because I wish that we didn't have to hide our sacred teachings, having our land taken away. In school, they tried to sugarcoat the topic of residential schools. Picture a flower. To me, they only talk about the flower above the ground, but never the messy roots below it. I wish I could be part of those discussions and ask, are you serious? What do you mean you didn't know the realities of IRS? I wish I knew my language. I wish I knew what our songs were. I wish I knew our stories. I wish I knew anything. In my old school, we had an Indigenous program in Slack Room. There were many things in the program that we did, one of them being drumming. Now, I don't remember everything, but I do remember the man who taught us how to make a drum, and he shared his story with us. Like me, his family has also suffered from intergenerational trauma because of the residential schools. Growing up, his mom was not as affectionate as he hoped she would be. I wish she was more loving, he said. He decided to break the chain of hurt when he became a parent by being more loving to his kids, and I never forgot that story. What if I knew more about my culture growing up? What if my connection didn't stop with my mother? What if the lack of this knowledge hadn't broken my identity? I can't change the past, but I'm growing now. I'm more confident in saying my nation and where I'm from. I've learned about tattoo traditions, about beading. It's sad that this happened, but my siblings did their best to pass down the knowledge they had retained from my birth mother. I learned the importance of smudging and cleansing. I remember learning that my culture was so close to me. My auntie, I call Cook'em, with whom my sibling would always joke, do you know how to cook your grandparents? You mush them and then you cook them. Mush them means grandpa. I am who I am, and that's good enough. I am Indigenous enough, and always have been. My name is Gabriel Iron Eagle, and I'm 14 years old. You were just listening to my origin story, where I talked about how I was disconnected from my culture. I'm growing and reconnecting with the help of the Native Youth Program that I'm part of this summer. I'm from the Key First Nation. I am Métis, Cree, and Soto. Thank you for listening to my frustration, but know that I would never actually bop someone in the nose. And you shouldn't either. Instead, give them the stink eye. Harmless but effective. Works sometimes. The NYP would like to give a special shout out to folks at CATR who made this audio documentary possible. Special thanks to Hene Imam, Karan Saxena, Eileen Peng, Jesper Son Yip, and Dora Duber. And our NYP program manager, Sephora Riggy Ledez.
Everything you'll ever need. Your little jailbird, your trying to save you before it all catches up, like cause you're gonna get burned. But I'm lying in bed to get miles away, feeling sick in the head, cause I'm lying awake and I'm left in your stead at the end of the day. No matter how much that I pray, everything stays washed out and straight to gray. You're my little jailbird, you're my little jailbird. Wings clipped, you can't fly free, but you still sing a hopeful song. Fucking knife under his clay, your eyes are full of trouble.